ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In 2022, Avani Dias took on the role of the ABC's South Asia correspondent based in Delhi. The subcontinent is the most populous region on Earth, and it contains a whole universe of peoples, religions, traditions, and languages. And as you might imagine, Avani was daunted and excited by the challenge of it all. This was her chance to report on one of the biggest stories of the decade, the re-emergence of India as a global economic and military giant, while still trying to hang on to its democracy. India's recent election was the biggest democratic exercise in the history of the planet, and Narendra Modi, the leader of India's BJP, was looking to secure a third term as India's Prime Minister. Avani has seen firsthand how Narendra Modi is idolised by so much of the country, and he presents himself as no ordinary leader. During the campaign, Modi said, quote, "When my mother was alive, I used to believe that I was born biologically. After she passed away, I was convinced that God has sent me. This energy could not be from my biological body, but was bestowed upon me by God." Although the election results were a setback for him, Modi remains enormously popular among India's Hindu majority. Modi is a Hindu nationalist, and although India is officially a secular state, its Muslim and Sikh minorities are feeling increasingly unwelcome in their own country. There are many adoring biographies of Modi, but there's so much about him that remains mysterious. So Avani Dias decided to make an ABC podcast series about his life, the utterly excellent Looking for Modi podcast. And so she travelled across India to meet people who knew him from a young age, and she tried to meet the wife that Modi has kept hidden for decades. Then, without warning, Avani found her own life entwined with the story, and she was told she had 2 weeks to leave the country. Hello, Avani.
Hi, Richard.
Your podcast begins with this great story about you going to see the cricket in Gujarat province, which is Modi's home province. Tell me about the spectacle you saw that day at the cricket.
I think the way I would describe it is fever dream. Like, it was so strange. We were in this travelling press pack with all these journalists from Australia who had come to India, and we get to this town, Ahmedabad. It's this massive regional town in Gujarat. And Anthony Albanese, the Australian Prime Minister's face, is on billboards everywhere. And Narendra Modi just loves to make other leaders feel special. And it's so smart to watch, right? Because they come in and they feel like they're this big rock star. And then we get into the stadium. It's the biggest stadium in the world, the biggest cricket stadium in the world. So it fits 130,000 people. Indian people going crazy, screaming. And then suddenly, we didn't know this was going to happen, Anthony Albanese and Narendra Modi step onto a chariot. They have all these guys around them with AK-47s, and everyone's screaming. It was a very bizarre thing to watch.
So he was going through the arena, Prime Minister Albanese with Prime Minister Modi on a chariot, like a victorious Roman general getting a triumph, essentially. And were there cheers?
There were cheers. Yeah, people were going nuts. And I think Albanese really loved it. He was like, wow, I'm a celebrity. People are so into me. Not sure how many of them actually knew who Mr. Albanese was. They obviously knew who Mr. Modi was, but yeah, it was a real spectacle.
Does Modi enjoy putting on spectacles like this to show how popular he is with other world leaders?
He loves it. And Mr. Modi, I do think after watching him for the last few years, he is a real genius when it comes to political campaigning. And that's both in getting close to international leaders. He makes them feel really special. I mean, imagine when other leaders come to Australia, you don't see the same kind of spectacles. But then when Mr. Modi either comes to another country or he invites other leaders to his country, he makes sure there's a show on. He makes sure that there's a viral moment. He knows how social media works. He knows how to do a great campaign. And he nails it with these shows, all this colour and this excitement, and it works.
The same thing happens when Modi came here. I mean, in comparison to when President Xi Jinping of China visited Australia, when we were getting on better with China, that was a pretty low-key, almost cool, icy cool affair. But there was a huge spectacular when Modi came to visit Australia. How has Australia's relationship with India changed in recent years, Avani?
It was really fascinating because when I arrived at the start of 2022, the relationship was just going up. Australia had seen India's potential. It saw it as this economic leader in the region. It's now one of the world's fastest growing economies. China was becoming a threat in the region. So Australia thought, okay, let's look to India as this kind of new regional partner. There's negotiations for a pretty massive free trade agreement going on at the moment. So things were just going up and up and up. We were really busy on the ground because Albanese kept coming to India. Modi went to Australia. There were all these interactions that we hadn't seen. And I think it was really fascinating. Because part of the reason why I wanted to be the correspondent was I thought the way that we looked at India from Australia was seeing it as this sort of undermined country, this place of poverty that was struggling, that really needed help from other nations. And I felt like that wasn't the right story that was being told about India. It's so much more than just poverty. It's this country that is emerging as a superpower. And Australia had finally caught on to that in the last decade or so. And it's just been going up and up.
Is there a feeling that India is a good counterweight to China, given that China's posture in militarily and diplomatically has become more front-footed, to say the very least, in recent years? India, on the other hand, is a democracy kind of sorter. I think that's probably the best way to put it right now. Is there a feeling in, I don't know, Washington, in Canberra, that India is a natural kind of fit for us? We have democratic traditions in common.
Totally. And Australia, the US, the UK, these countries constantly talk about the fact that India is the world's largest democracy. Modi loves to talk about it. And, you know, that is definitely up for dispute. And it's something that people are really discussing whether that's still the case. But these Western nations are putting it out there and saying, yeah, this is another democracy. We have these shared values. That was a term that was constantly used. So of course, we're going to get close to India. And it was a bit of a look at China and saying, hey, look, we've got a new mate in the region, and that's India. And because India has so many people, it had just taken over China as the world's most populous nation as well. It has this potential to become this military powerhouse in the area, and Australia wants to make sure it's on the right side.
One person I've heard talk about India said it's unlikely to become a global diplomatic powerhouse insofar as India is so complex and rich itself. It's kind of like a world unto itself, and it's not very outward looking. It's kind of interested in itself much more than the rest of the world. I don't know. That's true of the United States as well to a large degree. What do you think of all that, Ebony?
Yeah, it's an interesting take, right? And that's definitely what India has been traditionally. It's very internal focused. It grows all its own food. It doesn't have imported products. You know, we'd want to get a bottle of Australian wine and it was a real struggle because it's so expensive. And now that's sort of changing with these connections with Australia. But the thing is, India has been inward focused, but that's changed under Narendra Modi. Narendra Modi's mandate has come onto the scene. He's wanted to make India this global superpower that's being recognised by the world and changing that kind of outlook, saying, look, we're proud of our Indian roots. We're proud of what's happening inside our borders, but we want to put our Indian roots out there and let the rest of the world appreciate that. So that's something that Modi's really tried to change and do, but it's still kind of a discussion point whether India is ready to actually be that outward focus now.
So after this big extravaganza you saw at the cricket, after Prime Minister Albanese and Modi went through the grounds of the cricket stadium in this chariot, having conquered the Gauls and the Parthians and the Goths,
yeah.
You saw something take place afterwards when Narendra Modi was asked quite innocuous question about the cricket. What happened when that question was asked?
Yeah, so obviously our job as journalists when we're around leaders is to ask people questions. I'd seen Modi events. I'd been in press packs following Modi around. I'd seen him at natural disasters looking at the problems, and no one ever asks him a question. It's just a known rule in India. He just doesn't answer questions. They don't respond to questions that you send them via email. So to get a statement from the government is nearly impossible. Narendra Modi just does not interact with journalists unless he's specifically chosen and kind of media managed a very, very rare interview. That's the only time it ever happens. And then once we saw him answer one question in a press conference with Joe Biden. So I knew that this was the case, but there were all these other Australian journalists who had come to India for this tour. And so this one journalist, he asked Anthony Albanese a question. He got an answer. It was pretty straightforward. And then he asked Modi a question and he said something like, oh, what do you think of the cricket between India and Australia? Do you think we can survive it? It's a fun question. A politician would usually love that. And Modi just drew back and it was so strange to watch. He got a bit caught off guard and then he kind of stumbled out this weird answer. And I was like, oh, this guy's done the wrong thing, you know? And then we got a talking to and we were told just don't ask questions.
Why? Is it seen as like a damned impertinence, or is there another reason why Modi would not want to take questions from the press.
The reason is because Modi, he's so smart about his image, whether that's to international leaders or to the public, and he's curated this very specific image of himself, and he doesn't want that to be disrupted by any random journalist, even one from Australia. And Modi, I think what I've realised, is a very smart and calculated person. A lot of people I spoke to about Modi said that he plans everything and he wants to know what the next move is. So a question, a spontaneous question from a reporter just doesn't really cut it.
You said you saw billboards with Anthony Albanese's face on it. What does he do for himself? How much of a cult of the personality has Modi established in India today?
Well, the billboards of Albanese are nothing compared to Modi's face. I mean, I ended up travelling to most of the country. I wouldn't say most, it's such a huge country, but I got to a lot of different corners of India. Modi's face is everywhere, and he makes sure it's on billboards, it's on bus stops, it's when you're driving over a bridge. He's at the Cricket World Cup final, at the major cricket events. He makes sure he's in the minds of Indian people at all times, and it's effective. It becomes part of your psyche when you're driving around, when you're walking around. It's not even surprising to see Modi just right in your face. He's made himself India.
And how much do people talk about him at social events? Is he like Trump? Is he in America? Is he in name on everyone's lips there?
Absolutely. I mean, I'd go to parties with friends, and often it was a lot of journalists and diplomats and so on, and everyone is always talking about Modi. And that's not just because he's put himself in their face. It's because he has changed India in really dramatic ways. In the last 10 years as the leader of the country, he's shifted this place. And I think a lot of people are really being introspective about what India he's creating and what that means for them on the ground.
How about, you know, that's a party with clever people. What about if you're sitting at a chai stand? Do people do talk about him there and in the same way?
Totally. Like, I would go to chai stands, a great example. You'd go to the markets and speak to the vegetable sellers, and you would go to the equivalent of a housing commission block of apartments. And Modi has put himself there as well. And you know what was kind of weird to see? I covered the G20, which in Australia is kind of a boring foreign policy event, right? It's a bunch of world leaders coming here and discussing things. Somehow Modi made that about himself and made normal Indians care about the fact that he's putting India on the world stage. So you would speak to normal, ordinary citizens on the streets. And granted, I was asking them about Modi, but it was right front and center. It was some people saying he's not giving us jobs. It's some people saying things are too expensive. But Modi is still right at the front of people's minds.
Avani, you come from a family of journalists. You've got journalism in the blood. Your family originally from Sri Lanka. Does Sri Lankans have a kind of interesting perspective on India, sitting on this very beautiful island, but off the coast of India? Is India like this kind of gigantic, huge thing, presence, electrifying presence that's sort of just on your doorstep there?
Totally. And things are, you know, there's a lot of trade between the countries. It's the closest partner for Sri Lanka, for India. Sri Lanka is a big deal because China's trying to court it. Sri Lanka is definitely a place that looks at India and thinks about it often. And my family had a big connection with India. You know, my mum and my grandpa worked as a journalist as well in India. He was a diplomat there. Then my mum grew up there. My uncles were there. Even my dad has an interest and fascination with India. This is a place that people think about all the time. But part of the reason why I wanted to go there and be the coro there was because I wasn't just covering India, I was covering Sri Lanka as well. And it felt like a bit of ownership over the coverage for an extent, which was a really cool and empowering thing to do.
It's a funny thing, like when I read that you're the ABC's South Asia correspondent, it's like saying you're the Earth correspondent in a
way. Know.
I know. I mean, I'd be daunted by that. Despite what I said in the intro, I just guessed you were daunted, but I'm sure you were, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I think I should get the numbers right. Something like an eighth of the world's population or something, right? It's such a crazy amount of people. And it did often feel like you were running on a treadmill because there was just so much going on all the time. And it was really cool. In the last 6 months, we got to expand our bureau. I think while everyone is looking at Modi, thinking about Modi and the place of India in the world, Australia's thinking about India. The ABC also is thinking about the fact that this is a really important place for Australians to know and understand. And I think it's great that there's this expansion going. The problem is there are no other Australian journalists based there. And to me, that's wild. It's shocking that we're not thinking more about this behemoth in the region.
So you arrived to live in Delhi in the north of India. What was it like to arrive there and take on the job there in that bureau?
Well, this is a bureau that's been there for around 60 years. So you're stepping into this place which has this huge institutional reputation in terms of delivering an understanding to Australians. I think that the privilege of doing that job is sort of being there, immersing yourself, living in this new place, learning about it, understanding it, and then taking what you think and presenting it to Australian audiences. I feel a little bit emotional talking about it because it is such a privilege and an exciting thing to do. I felt each day that I was there, I was learning more about this place and immersing myself. It felt like, I don't know, this thing that I didn't really understand before I got there became more of a thing that I could get around and try to understand myself. And then telling people about what was going on the ground was an enormous privilege, but definitely a nerve-wracking experience.
After the British left, the place had its independence. In the late 1940s, the subcontinent split into three different nations. There was Pakistan in the west, India, the gigantic thing right in the middle, and East Pakistan, which later became Bangladesh, to the east. How much does that partition of India into those nations still have a lingering effect in India today, Avani?
It's huge because, firstly, it's a point in history that I think every Australian should know about, and I didn't know enough when I went there, but it is a part of everyday life. I mean, it was 1947. People who've experienced it are still alive. Their kids are still alive. That mass migration, you know, Muslims were told to go to Pakistan. Hindus were told to go to Hindu-majority India. It was the biggest mass migration potentially in history. There were so many deaths, and you can feel that kind of trauma. And there's this feeling on the ground that people need to get out that kind of trauma.
As you said, a great many Muslims left what is now India to go and live in Pakistan or Bangladesh. But a great many Muslims also stayed, and it's a minority now. India is, what, 80% Hindu? Nonetheless, how many Muslims roughly are there in modern-day India?
It's around 200 million Muslims.
So it's still one of the biggest Muslim countries in the world?
Yeah, I think it's at least in the top five, only after countries like Indonesia. It is a huge number of Muslims that still live in India because India at its core and in its constitution is a secular country. So yes, 80% of the country is Hindu, but there are many Muslims. There are hundreds of millions of them. There are many Sikhs, Christians, Jains, it's enormously diverse.
So as we said, Modi has this messianic appeal in much of India, particularly amongst its Hindu population. Has he brought real change for people? He's often adored by people on the lower socioeconomic rungs of Indian society. Has he brought real change to their lives?
Absolutely, to an extent. And I think this is, again, something that politicians around the world can learn a lot about. You know, in Australia, we see welfare policies and you hear the term dole bludges thrown around in Australia all the time. In India, the welfare policies for Modi really won him his popularity. He saw these people in poverty and he gave them things like toilets and a roof over their heads and food rations and medical rations. He was basically giving cash handouts in the form of vouchers and infrastructure. And people who were in these really dire circumstances thought, wow, he's given us a toilet. That's huge. We just adore him for this. And the fact that the Modi government was offering these things was really resonating with people, even though it was such minuscule things in their day-to-day lives.
And is this contrasted with the Congress Party in India, which has been the dominant party since independence, which has largely been dominated by the Gandhi dynasty? Is this seen as, like, the revenge of the people further down the economic ladder?
Totally. And, you know, the Congress Party and, you know, the first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, after independence, his descendants effectively led India, and they were these Oxford-educated, English-speaking, high-rung, rich people in India. And they were popular for a while, then they were really affected by corruption. And Modi came along and he said, I'm an ordinary guy. I grew up just like you. I grew up in humble circumstances. I'm normal and I'm against corruption and I feel the way that you do. And that was a message that resonated so much with Indian people.
Now, there have been a great many adoring biographies written of Narendra Modi. What made you think that it was a good idea to pursue his life story? What didn't you know about his story that is often printed in these adoring biographies?
There was so much. I think the fact, A, that he was so much in my face and in everyone else's face, and he had made it his mission to make his story a part of his appeal, that really fascinated me. I had heard around just talking to people that he had this crazy backstory with his wife that really drew me in. And I have always been interested, you know, looking at the far right in places like Australia, looking at groups like the Proud Boys, and I had no idea that Modi had these really, really interesting and kind of concerning roots in this giant far-right organization in India that has a huge hold over the country and is really influential. And I just wanted to know more.
So what do we know about his early years, the place he was born, his childhood?
So Modi grew up in a small town in Gujarat, which is in the west of India. We know that he's from a lower caste. So India has a very strict hierarchical caste system.
Even today? Them. That's still a thing today?
Even today, it's being phased out by some people, especially in the higher sort of intellectual sections. But still, especially in regional areas, it's still really embedded in society.
And that's the world he was born into.
Yeah, and his sort of caste, they were vegetable oil producers in Gujarat. They were definitely a humble home. I went to his hometown. I saw his old house. It's not the poorest of poor, but it is definitely middle of the road. And he was 8 when he joined this group called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which researchers say it's the largest far-right organization in the world. They say that it has paramilitary roots because there are these martial arts exercises taught to kids from as young as 8, like Modi was. And we know that he worked his way up through the organization for so many years and then eventually joined its political arm, which is the more mainstream version of the RSS. It's the party called the BJP, and that's what he's been a part of for many years now. And it's obviously leading the country at the moment.
How long has this organization, RSS, been around for?
So it's been around for decades, but it was really inspired, and it's really quite fascinating reading what its founders were inspired by. They looked at Nazi ideology. Some of the people connected to the RSS looked at Mussolini and how he was functioning in Italy. There was a lot of
interest. Consciously modelled themselves on Mussolini?
They all read and talked about this idea of fascism, and the reason why was because the RSS believes that secular India should be a Hindu-dominant state. So the fact that there are these many, many religions that are operating in India, it says those religions should be respecting Hinduism first, and Hinduism should be the dominant religion here.
So RSS, is that like those far-right or fascist movements from the early 20th century? It has a lot of physical exercises, a paramilitary wing, a focus on blood and soil politics, and we are the nation and they are not the nation over there. How was Modi brought into this organisation? What did he get from it as a teenager when he joined RSS?
So it's kind of a classic of these types of organisations where they appeal to children. And when you're in a small town like Modi was, there's not much going on, and then you see the fact that this group is running daily meetings and they're called shakas, and you kind of wake up really early, you put up a saffron flag which represents now the Hindu rite, you do these rituals in the morning, you do chants and so on, and then you do these sort of military exercises with each other, and then you kind of talk and you discuss ideas around the Hindu religion and what that means and how that could dominate. I spoke to one of Modi's friends who went to these RSS meetings with him, and he said, it actually gave me a sense of belonging, somewhere to go, something to do. I made friends. And then you kind of grow up through the organization, and then you kind of appeals to the roots that the organisation is trying to promote, and you get indoctrinated.
So this is an organisation that's been around for nearly 100 years now. It starts in 1925. It has its own private army. It asks all these things of its young male adherents. Now, it arrived on the scene at the point where there was the independence movement being started and led by Mahatma Gandhi. What did RSS make of Gandhi as a leader?
The RSS was really questioning Gandhi, and Gandhi was promoting this idea that India should be an equal place and a secular place, and should be, you know, many different religions, and many people in the RSS didn't like that. And the RSS has been accused of many quite high profile instances of violence over the last century.
Yeah. What did they make of Gandhi's insistence on non-violent protest?
Well, it was against that. And obviously the RSS, which is sort of teaching people how to sort of fight and these sort of military exercises, wasn't really happy with this approach towards the British, which were the colonizers at that time. And so there were people that were sympathetic to that cause.
Is there a stress on like the benefits of violence as opposed to it as a sad but necessary tactic? Did they have a different view of violence, that in some way the act of violence would actually be a positive good for India and for its adherents?
So the way the RSS sort of sees these sort of military exercises is to kind of think of it like protecting yourself against the invaders. That's how they talk about it. It's dealing with this outside force. And at that point, the British were the outside force. Now minorities are the outside force. And I should say that now the RSS, there are elements of it that have moved away from that really extreme ideology. There are elements that don't necessarily agree with it. It denies it's a paramilitary organization, but at the same time, its leader recently came out and said it could defend India at a moment's notice. And we also know that a member of the RSS assassinated Mahatma Gandhi, this sort of freedom fighter for India, this crazy high profile case. I knew he had been killed. I didn't know it was by someone who had previously been a member of the RSS. And at that time, the RSS was banned in India.
Do we know if the assassin who killed Gandhi performed the assassination at the behest of the leadership of RSS, or is that not known?
So that's really unclear. And the RSS, when it happened, really distanced itself from the assassin and said, look, we don't actually have a connection to him. But there's since been so much research which shows he was a part of the RSS.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Yeah, we were talking before about how Modi grew up and joined this far-right organisation, RSS, as quite a young man, as a boy, in fact. For a long time, he claimed he was not married as a leader. Did that benefit him or harm him to be unmarried in that context as a leader of a state province before he became prime minister?
It's super interesting, right, Richard, because I feel like politicians in the West, they really want to show themselves as a family person or get themselves some kind of human story by having a partner and kids. And in India, it's kind of different. If you are, you know, Mahatma Gandhi, for example, took a vow of celibacy to say, I'm committed to my country and only my country. It's almost this religious dedication to the country.
So he's in the tradition of that then, is he, to claim that for himself?
Yeah, and Narendra Modi was out there as he was growing through his political career saying, I don't have anything else in my life. It's just you. I just want to dedicate myself to this country and to you as Indian people. And that's the only thing I care about. I don't have a family. I don't have connections to other people. I don't have anything else distracting me. And it's this almost religious monk-like dedication and focus on the country was how he was trying to promote himself.
So in his first run at the prime ministership, one of the opposition parties revealed that he was in fact married. What are the circumstances of this marriage?
This is a really crazy story. And the more I kind of peeled back on it, I was like, this is wild. But basically it goes back to when Modi was 3. So he was in this caste, and traditionally you are meant to marry within your caste. That's a tradition that's kind of being let go of now in modern day India, but still respected. And obviously in 1960s India, when Modi was a kid, his parents wanted him to get married to a woman within the same sort of class system. So they promised him to this woman in a nearby village. Obviously they were kids at this point. And then the way that the marriage goes in his caste, when they're sort of 11, 12, they got engaged. And I should note, this isn't a child marriage. It's just sort of a betrothal, I guess is the way to put it. And then when they were 17, 18, they went through this traditional ceremony of marriage with their families in the town. But the thing was, Narendra Modi, you know, he'd just gone through many years in the RSS, and he was a bit of a rebel at the same time. You know, he's this guy that respects the traditional side of India and is the respect of parents, but he also wanted more for himself as a person. And also I met a lot of his friends who said he was really stubborn as well. He wanted to just do what he wanted. And he said, look, I'm not interested in marriage. Packed up his bags and he told his wife, her name's Yashodhan Modi, he said, look, you can live with my parents, which is what traditionally happens. You can do whatever you want. we can, you know, keep this relationship, but I'm leaving and I don't want to talk to you anymore. And you can do what you want, but I'm going. And he packed up his bags and he went to the Himalayas. And his parents were really angry. I met one of their neighbors in his hometown and she said she remembers the day that he left. His mother was inconsolable. Another friend said it was like it was a day of mourning and Modi had died because he just packed up and left.
So she's led a life entirely without him. How have things changed for her since he became this very powerful prime minister?
Things haven't changed at all, really. I mean, I went to her home village. I went to her hometown. She's living a really ordinary life. She volunteers at a local hospital. She's just a normal person. And if you saw her on the street, you would not think anything of her. And most people, you know, obviously people in her town know that she's Modi's wife, but most people wouldn't even recognize her in India. When you compare that with first ladies around the world, I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling, especially when India, some leaders have been very open and kind of promoting their wives in public.
So he left his wife behind, he rose up through the RSS, joined the BJP, the political party, and in 2001 he becomes the chief minister of Gujarat province, which is a bit like becoming a state premier in this sort of kind of in Australian terms there. Just a few months into his term there as the governor of Gujarat province, communal riots broke out. What do we know about how they started and his response to those riots?
This was a really black mark on Modi's career, and it's something that keeps getting dug up. But these riots, effectively, there was this campaign that the BJP had led along with the RSS and other Hindu right-wing groups to build a Hindu temple where a Muslim mosque had once stood in a town called Ayodhya in the north of India. And there was this campaign running for many years. A lot of religious pilgrims were traveling back and forth between Ayodhya and their hometowns. And a group of them were traveling back to Gujarat on a train. So it's a couple of days' journey. It's all across the country. And they stopped at a station called Godra. And then things got really nasty. There was clashes. There's different people have different versions of what happened that day. Some people say that there were clashes with Muslims on the platform. Other people say Muslims attacked the train. It's been heavily disputed in Indian history. But what we do know is the train carriage where hundreds of these pilgrims were in, it caught fire. And then a lot of people died. And Narendra Modi had just gotten the chief ministership of Gujarat at this point. It was a big test for his leadership. And his government approved the bodies of these victims to be brought out and put in the middle of a city. And that was despite the fact that some authorities were saying this could trigger riots, this could really pop off and really exaggerate and really kick off this anger among people. And
that's what happened?
That's exactly what happened. We saw looting of Muslim homes and businesses, many Muslim people killed. There were some Hindus killed in retaliation as well, but the majority of people that were killed were Muslims. And then we saw those riots sort of kicking off other riots around the country. And it was just a really dark period. And it's been a stain on Modi because after that, he was banned from going to the US. He was banned by European governments, the UK. The US accused him of being involved in sort of anti-religious sentiments, and it lasted for 10 years, that ban.
In 2014, he led his party, the BJP, to victory in the national elections of that year. Was this, again, seen as the triumph of the lower class people against the Brahmins of the upper class Congress Party and the other upper class parties of India?
It was seen as a victory for the people, according to Modi and his party. He said, look, we've won against these elites, you know, I'm the normal person. And he also said it was a time for economic growth, you know, the corruption days were over and now was the time to make India reach its full potential as an economic leader.
Under his rule, what's happened to the stable pillars of Indian democracy, the separation of powers, for example? What's happened to the court system, to the media, to the legislature? How much of a check are these institutions providing on his personal power now?
You know, some people listening might think India, of course, there's no democratic institutions. It's a country that's in Asia. That's not going to happen. But India traditionally has had a very, very strong democratic foundation. The sheer size of the electoral voting system is incredible. There are hundreds of millions of people who vote. We just saw more than, I think it was like 620 million voting in the last election. They have these electronic voting machines and they make sure that they go across the Himalayas, across forests in Gujarat, oceans. They make sure every person that could vote can have the option to vote. So it's a pretty incredible feat. But what we saw since Narendra Modi came to power 10 years ago is an undermining of these institutions and a threat to them. We've seen parliament situations where opposition members are kicked out by Modi and his party because he doesn't like the kind of debate that's unfolding in parliament, and that's the kind of basis of a democratic parliament, right? We are seeing journalists killed in parts of India. We are seeing jailing of journalists, and we know that freedom of the press is a huge pillar of democracy. But what we are seeing is an increase in these sorts of events, especially in parts like Kashmir, which is a disputed region and quite a focus point for the Indian government. We are seeing a lot of journalists there being killed, and a lot of concerns from groups like Reporters Without Borders about the safety of the press in India, because there's a huge pro-Modi government media, especially among the mainstream press now, that really just promotes the Modi government's point of view. And what we've seen is, for example, NDTV, a huge mainstream media organization, which is now owned by Adani, who is a close business partner, even you could say, but a close business affiliate of the Modi government. And he owns that media institution. And we've seen that institution go towards the Modi government in its coverage now. So there's a lot of concern about the kind of stories that are being portrayed and who's actually influencing them.
You know, we're talking about the far-right RSS organization that he was a member of. When that started, those sort of movements were all studying each other very carefully. Lenin was the first to set up a kind of an one-party state, and Mussolini studied Lenin, Hitler studied Mussolini. It sounds like the RSS was studying Mussolini as well. They're all taking tips from one another. Do you get the sense, or do people say, that Modi is studying like Erdogan's Turkey, for example, or even, which is a different kind of thing, but even Singapore's People's Actions Party, where it tolerates an opposition, but they're constantly confronted with like lawsuits and defamation actions in the court when they try to criticise the government of the day? Are they watching similar regimes like that, or Viktor Orban's Hungary?
I think Modi is studying regimes all over the world, whether that's in the West or that's in places like Turkey and so on. I think Modi has tried to really bring in different successful elements of these different regimes, whether it's campaigning, whether it's in terms of leadership. As we've discussed, Modi says that his whole mind and focus is about leading India. And I think he is a student of a lot of these different kind of regimes and political leaders, because he wants to create his own unique version of India, but he also wants it to be one that is inspired by different places, for sure.
Is there anything like a secret police in India today?
So look, it's not in the sense of you getting pulled off the street and being asked, you know, who said what at what time, but it is pressure from the government. I mean,
and how does that make itself felt?
Well, for journalists, it means that you get called up by the government pretty often and you get questioned and told about the kind of coverage that you're being told. When I've been shooting stories, we've definitely been followed around by Indian authorities. We've been questioned on the streets. We've been blocked from going into events.
Now, this was this foreign correspondence story you made. What was the nature of this story? What was it about?
It's about the fact that the Narendra Modi government has been cracking down on dissidents overseas, and in the most high-profile cases, India has been accused of assassinating people who are speaking out against the Indian state. One Sikh separatist was killed in Canada. There's another alleged murder plot in the US. And what we have looked at in this Four Corners story that's just come out as well is the fact that that's happening in Australia as well. We don't have evidence that they're killing people here, but we know that they are threatening them. When they're speaking about out against the Indian state here in Australia, they're Australian citizens, they're interested in India, they're activists, but then they're getting threatened by Indian authorities. So no, they're not pulling people off the streets necessarily, but they're threatening their families in India. They're calling them and saying, stop the activism. And that's happening to Australians as well. And I think that's a really terrifying element of how the Indian government's operating. It's quite subtle, it's quite sinister, but it's definitely happening.
So you made this foreign correspondent episode about the assassination of a Sikh separatist in Canada last year. The Canadian government was up in arms about this. Justin Trudeau made a speech very angry about it. Wasn't naming certain names, but nonetheless said he was going to draw the gravest possible conclusions from this assassination of a Canadian citizen. And you said you were pulled in? What happened when you were pulled in? What questions were asked of you?
So we were asked what we were shooting, who was in our crew. There were a few people from the Australian arm of the ABC who'd flown over, why they had come here, what we were looking into. Then I got calls from government officials asking me where I was, what I was doing. And then when I tried to shoot a public event on the India-Pakistan border, we were stopped from going to film that event. And so while these are sort of may seem like small, innocuous things, A, there's a build-up, but B, this is supposed to be a democratic country, the world's biggest democracy, and this is how we were being treated. But the thing is that the Indian government sees this Sikh separatist movement that wants the state of Punjab to become its own nation. It sees this as a terror threat. And so it's really sensitive about this issue, clearly, and it really wants to control the narrative around it.
What happened when that story went to air, the foreign correspondent story?
So the story went up, and a couple of days later, the Indian government took it down and said it was a national security threat, and it was banned on YouTube. It was blocked on Facebook and Instagram. Letters were sent to the ABC. And I thought at that time, okay, that's the extent of what will happen, but it escalated the very next day.
Meanwhile, you needed to get your visa extended to remain as the South Asia correspondent, which is normally a routine matter. What happened when you tried to get your visa extended?
Yeah, so I'd applied for it months earlier, and usually it's a pretty simple process. We get year-to-year visas. It's pretty straightforward. It's a bit of boring admin, and then you get it done. But it had been months since I'd heard about it. And, you know, at that time when I applied, we went on this shoot in Punjab where we got these sort of threats and were followed and so on. And then once the sort of story was blocked online, I got this call from a government official who said, look, your visa's not getting extended. You've got 2 weeks. You can go. Your story was too extreme. It crossed a line were the exact words that he used. And I said, look, this is an international story. Everyone's covering it, obviously. And he said, yeah, but you went further by actually going to these places, meeting with some of the supporters of this group, going to the house of the victim. And he said, look, you went much further by actually physically going to this place. One of the revelations in our story in Foreign Correspondent was that there were many authorities that had visited the family of this Canadian victim over many weeks just before he died. And that was an element they were concerned about. And we had also put in very openly the fact that we had been followed and kind of threatened by authorities in India.
You put that in the story, did you?
Yeah, and I don't think they like that. And I think the bigger thing also, India just doesn't like documentaries and television features. You know, we saw India raiding the BBC for a documentary critical of Modi's role in the Gujarat riots, which we spoke about earlier. And that happened a few months earlier. So the Indian government really doesn't like, I guess, visuals out there and in the open. It's something it really cracks down on.
You mentioned you'd been getting threats while you're in that, well, you said in the Punjab region, is that right? What form did those threats take?
So they were more just sort of, I would say to the government official, well, we're not doing anything wrong, right? We're just out here shooting it. And they'd just be like, well, we'll see what happens. And again, it's not necessarily a threat, but it gets under your skin where it makes you feel like you are doing something wrong. And the feeling is, well, something bad will happen to you if you don't stop.
Right. It was like, be it on your head if you proceed with this story. So what about the courts in India? Are the courts constraining Modi in any way, or is there enormous pressure on them to not to constrain him and the exercise of his power?
The courts are a really interesting element of this, right? Because we've seen the press, we've seen Parliament, and definitely they were under threat by Narendra Modi. But then when it came to the courts, I think a lot of people had faith in the courts. But what we would also see would be a really smart use of the court system. The BJP would find a court in a state that was sympathetic to the BJP or find a judge that was sympathetic to the BJP and file court action in that particular state against a particular person or a party or whatever. And then that would lead to them being convicted of something. And then, of course, you could appeal, but India's court system is so huge and takes so long. The judicial system has so much backlog that you're just stuck in this administrative loop. And that's another tactic that's used. You know, it's kind of hard to explain to you, Richard, how these threats and this kind of clampdown works because it is really refined and really subtle in different ways. But a part of it is just getting people in a loop of bureaucracy, whether that's applying for a visa and never hearing back or whatever, or whether that's dealing with the court system and being stuck in the loop of the Indian court system, which could take years, if not decades.
As you say, Modi comes from the RSS and the BJP, which is the political party of the RSS, which has for nearly a century now argued that India should not be a secular state. It should be a Hindu nationalist state. What's happened since he's come into power along those lines? Has he just treated that as a bit of embarrassing stuff from his past, or is he going so far as to enact these Hindu nationalist ideas now that he's prime minister?
He has enacted many policies which reflect this idea that India should be a Hindu first state. We have seen the region of Kashmir, for example, which is the only Muslim majority area in India. It used to have its own autonomous constitution. It's fought over by India and Pakistan. And Narendra Modi's government came in and said, we're taking ownership and power over that region, the Indian side of Kashmir. That was hugely controversial.
Right, he's removed a lot of its autonomy then, has he?
Correct,
right.
And that led to massive protests. We've seen a citizenship law come in, which allows people who've migrated to India from neighbouring countries like Afghanistan and Bangladesh and Pakistan to get citizenship in India, but only if you're not Muslim. Even though they are Muslim majority countries, there was a lot of anger around that as well. We've seen in some BJP-led states since Modi came to power, bans on inter-religious marriage. So marriage between Hindus and Muslims been really cracked down on. We've seen so many examples of these policies that are coming in, which have actively changed the fabric of India and pushed this idea that India is a Hindu first state.
What do Hindu nationalists want Muslims to do? Do they want to accept second-class citizen status, or would they rather they all leave and went to Bangladesh and Pakistan or elsewhere, another a Muslim-majority country?
I think it depends which ones you ask and question, but I think the broader consensus is you're allowed to stay, but you need to respect that this is a Hindu-first country, that we are the dominant religion, that our religion trumps yours. And that's the sort of mainstream section and the belief groups like the RSS and the BJP. But then there are more extreme versions of the RSS, which are actively out there engaging in religious violence and kind of dealing with Muslims in a way that's extremely violent. And I think perhaps the kind of pinnacle of these policies has been the opening of a Hindu temple where a mosque once stood in this northern part of India. And it's been this long-standing campaign by the BJP for decades. Modi's made it a big part of his leadership. And in January this year, he opened that Hindu temple. And that was seen as a real symbol, you know, the taking down of a mosque for a Hindu temple. He says, and many Hindu believers say, that this important god Ram was born there and they have entitlement to this space. So the idea is that it's a Hindu country, and that was taken away by invaders like the Mughals and the Muslim empires and so on, and this is a reclaiming of that identity.
So your visa to stay in India had been held up and held up and held up, and part of you must be thinking, am I imagining things or is there a real serious problem here? How did all that come to a head, Abby?
So once I got that call saying that it wasn't going to come through, the Australian government stepped in and started negotiating on my behalf and was saying, look, this is not going to be a good thing for the kind of image of India as a democratic state and kind of the relationship between the two countries. It was all happening behind the scenes. But each day I was getting these updates from the Australian government, and it was just day by day getting closer to my last day and the flight home. And then you get to the point where you think, okay, I've got to pack up. I've got to book a flight. My partner was living with me, and we had to really figure out logistically what we were going to do. We had all these plans after, you know, my visa was meant to expire, which we had to cancel. And so each day it got closer and closer and closer. And as that was happening, we were trying to plan our election coverage as well. And I wasn't getting a pass to cover the election. The accreditation I needed to cover the election wasn't coming on the ground. The Indian government's now said that's because my visa was in limbo, but I still was finding that I was just struggling to actually do my job. So I was running out of time. I figured that it was probably going to be just too tough to cover this election with all this kind of scrutiny and this pressure. And I had to make the call 3 days before our flight that, yeah, we were pulling the pin because we just had to pack the boxes and get out of the country. And then 24 hours before my flight home, maybe not even 24 hours, it was the night before, I got that visa for 2 months, a 2-month extension instead of the 1 year. But obviously by that point, it's too late. But now the Indian government has very openly come out and said, oh, well, we gave you the visa. And when I got home and this all became public, they started to discredit me publicly, which was a very, very unsettling experience.
How did they do that or try to do that?
Well, they come out and said that I recently got married, and they said that I was coming home for a marriage or a new job. These Modi sympathetic YouTubers and these massive publications that are sympathetic to Modi said, oh, that I was making it all up and that I just was doing it for attention. And it was a really weird and unsettling week when all these people were sort of coming out and saying, you know, that I was a fraud effectively in India.
So it sounds very Trump-like to me, all of this. Sounds like what happens when people speak out against Donald Trump. But now you're back here in Australia. You had in the end, had a much shorter stint than you would have wanted in India. How do you feel about India now that you're back in Australia?
You know, the funny thing is, you know, the crackdown that you get from Modi sympathisers is this giant troll army. And what they kept saying to me was that I was a race traitor because I was this, you know, I have brown skin and I am reporting about this country. And I wanted to report in South Asia because I felt this personal connection to it. I've always heard about my family talking about India. We'd visited there when I was younger. It's a place that I think is amazing. I loved living there. My partner and I settled there. We have amazing friends there. Delhi is a crazy, amazing city. We traveled all over the country. It's so diverse and special. And so when people come out and say you're a race traitor, it doesn't feel great, obviously. They said much worse than that, I should put out there as well. And so now I look back on India, obviously it's such a special place. I'm sad that I can't go back likely for a few years, maybe not till a change of government. I was sad to miss the election coverage that recently happened. And I think that there's a lot of self-reflection and a lot of introspection happening in India about the future of the country, because we've seen a really interesting election result. Narendra Modi won, but he didn't win with the majority that he wanted. He has to work with these coalition partners that don't agree with them. And I think with the people who are questioning India's future, there's a bit of hope about what that might mean for democracy in India and the crackdown on dissidents and freedom of speech. So I still feel very affectionately towards India. I miss it a lot. It's nice to be back home with family and friends in a secure place where you're not being fully cracked down on by the government. It's just a tiny little bit sometimes, but I definitely miss it.
It's been fantastic speaking with you, Avani. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Richard.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Avani Dias is an ABC journalist, and you can listen to her, I'll use the phrase again, utterly excellent podcast series, Looking for Modi, on the ABC Listen app or from wherever you get your podcasts. And Avani's Four Corners story, Infiltrating Australia, is now available for you to watch on iView. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.